Hello, you're listening to a special recording of the Science Council's 2013 Gareth Roberts Lecture, this year given by Baroness Honora O'Neill. The lecture was titled, Why Science Needs Ethics, Why Science Cannot and Should Not Aspire to be Value-Free. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, which is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist point of view. You can find more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's go over to Baroness O'Neill kicking things off.
And my topic may seem to you very old hat. I think it should be old hat, but I keep on hearing people referring to aspirations or expectations that science should be value-free. Of course, a position we date back to the 1920s and 30s, to the origins of logical positivism. And I also know that probably the arguments were nailed 40 years ago. But I thought it bears revisiting because this assumption seems continually to recur. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Because what I think the view that lingers is that science is a matter of inquiry that aims at proof, as in mathematics, or at empirical truths, as in more experimental work, but it shouldn't make and it shouldn't rely on normative claims, nor in particular on ethical claims. That's the thought about value neutrality. Those thoughts are just sloganed as encapsulated as science should be value-free. I actually think that view is mistaken, demonstrably mistaken. Scientific thinking and practice, I'm going to argue, depends on a range of standards, and any choice or reliance on standards is a matter of selecting and relying on some norms and rejecting others. And those norms cannot be established by empirical methods. And some of those norms are what we normally think of as ethical standards. So it follows, I think, that empiricism, as we usually understand it, can't be the whole story, and science shouldn't aspire to be value-free. That's a sort of potted version, so no surprises. But perhaps this bit will be a little bit more surprising, and I don't know how commonplace this distinction is, between two directions of fit. I think the distinction between normative and empirical claims is robust. When we make empirical claims, we seek to fit what we say to the way the world is, and we accept we're going to have to retract our claims if they turn out not to be true of the way things are. That responsiveness to the way things are is fundamental to empirical and, in particular, to scientific inquiry. We none of us, I think, doubt that. When we make normative claims, we endorse or rely on standards to which action should live up, by which we seek to shape or reshape the world in some very small part. So empirical claims are to be shaped to fit the world, and aspects of the world are to be shaped to fit normative claims. Philosophers have, for some 50 years, spoken of this distinction as a distinction between two directions of fit. I don't know how well that distinction has travelled. I find it useful. It was actually, I won't say popularised, because the place where it was first used very widely was in a rather influential, but I have to say not very accessible, book called Intention, written by my former tutor Elizabeth Anscombe when I was very young in the early 60s at Cambridge. It was a rather new book. And she told an everyday story about a man who's asked by his wife to do the shopping, and who, for reasons about which nothing at all is said in the story, is followed around by a detective who records what he buys. And when he comes home, his wife complains about his shopping performance, saying, "Look, it says butter and you've bought margarine." Anscombe points out that he can hardly reply, "What a mistake! We must put that right and alter the list to read margarine." The shopping list is intended to be normative for the shopper's performance, action guiding, not descriptive of it. So it's not meant to be revised when a mistake's made. But the detective's list is meant to be descriptive of the shopper's performance, so it must be revised if it misrecords what is actually bought. So much for the basic distinction on which I'm going to rely, which again, I think has proved robust. Norms come in many kinds, however, and I'm going to say rather little, a bit at the end, about differences between ethical and political, legal, prudential, technical, social, or other types of norms that we constantly invoke in everyday life, and for that matter, in more arcane bits of life. It's widely, I think, accepted that in any systematic activity, norms of some or many sorts are going to have to be deployed, and that we'll gain no traction by ignoring that fact and focusing solely on descriptive, or even more narrowly, on supposedly explanatory aspects of reasoning. That point reflects and does not dispute the Humean adage that it's impossible to derive ought from is. But it doesn't make the further and fallacious inference that if norms can't be derived from facts, they can't be justified, so are dispensable in empirical, let alone scientific, inquiry. We can't pursue practical aims without relying on standards that are taken to be normative for the relevant domain. Now, despite that widespread recognition that norms are central to any organized pursuit of practical aims, I think there's often very patchy recognition of the scope and importance of normativity for systematic inquiry, including scientific reasoning and practice. And I think this may be, in the first place, a matter of intellectual history. The history norm belonged, in some ways perhaps it still belongs, to sociology and other branches of social inquiry, which investigate the standards, rules, and norms that certain others, for example certain social or professional groups, actually accept and that they put into practice in the relevant contexts. But empirical inquiries into norms focus on the norms that are actually accepted by some group at some time, but they neither adopt those norms nor address questions about their justification or lack of justification. And that's surely totally appropriate in studying others' norms. Empirical study of others' norms has become a routine activity. Some would say it's overdone for sociologists, historians, and other social scientists, not to mention for pollsters and the PR firms whom businesses and politicians pay rather handsomely to discover and tabulate the norms and attitudes held by particular groups. But empirical inquiries into others' normative commitments simply bracket questions about the justification, if any, of those norms. It neither need endorse nor need adopt the norms that are investigated. And many groups and individuals, of course, adopt norms that others find repugnant, contentious, even dire. Just think of the norms that get expressed in religious persecution or regimes of terror or in everyday practices of prejudice or exclusion. But this is irrelevant if the aim is just to investigate others' norms by empirical methods, as typically in the sorts of sociological, historical, and pollsters' work I've mentioned. However, investigators cannot proceed without their own normative commitments, and here questions of justification do arise for them. The difficulty is to see how those questions are going to be answered. And claims that inquiry, in particular scientific inquiry, should be value-free or value-neutral, are in effect claims that there are insurmountable obstacles to any justification. That's a sensitive matter. I sometimes feel that the gap between is and ought, of which we've all been warned since we were very small, is like one of those fatal spots to which suicides or would-be suicides are drawn, perhaps out of fear of investigating what lies in that direction and may lead to disaster. One rather common avoidance tactic is a tendency to overvalue a focus on those empirical claims about norms that I was just describing. It's sometimes, I think, fueled by fears that it might be possible to move from claims that certain norms are accepted to claims that they ought to be accepted, thereby supposedly short-circuiting the supposed taint of relying on normative claims. As I see it, any attempt to discern normative force in the fact that norms are actually accepted by some is going to end in failure, unless it's perhaps supplemented by implausible forms of relativism or unconvincing arguments from authority. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about arguments from authority. They've got a bad name, especially in science, but many other places too, but I want to differentiate them a bit. Typically, attempts to show that the acceptance of norms can be justified is done by invoking some authority. And sometimes this is adequate. In their proper context, arguments from authority have some weight. In a court of law, an appeal to statute or precedent has some weight. In a commercial context, an appeal to contract has some weight. In international political discussion, treaty obligations have some weight. Within a church, appeals to the authority of Scripture or its authorized interpretation or to ecclesiastical tradition may have some weight. In professional life, appeals to agreed and established standards of professional conduct have some weight. In these defined contexts, there are recognized authorities that are taken to be legitimate to whom we can appeal. But invoking supposed authorities and their conventions isn't a matter of justifying at any deep level. It's justification relative to those authorities. Those who are taken as authorities might, after all, not have set convincing standards. Their norms might be no more than currently accepted conventions. People often make these claims about the norms by which other people, other groups, other institutions conduct their lives. But it is a matter of pride and principle that arguments from authority shouldn't have weight in scientific and other empirical inquiries. Here they're supposed to have no purchase. So if we want justification of standards, rules, and norms without appeal to authority, we're going to have to embark on far more difficult journeys. Can justifications of the epistemic, logical, and other norms, perhaps ethical norms, on which scientific and other practices of inquiry rely, actually avoid appeals to authority? I think that's, so to speak, a tender spot. We'd like to see how to do it. And I believe that it's that sort of consideration which tells us why it's so tempting to avoid the whole task and the whole area by continuing, at least in off-guard moments, to say, oh, well, science, of course, is value-free or value-neutral. But if we don't think arguments from authority acceptable, where can we turn? To what extent can we expect to justify the normative claims on which we in fact rely? Can we even get started unless we just accept that certain norms are given or authoritative? If we do that, don't we eventually appeal, even in the case of the norms of scientific inquiry and practice, to the authority of conventions, traditions, or the edicts of supposed authorities? What then are we to say to those whose views of scientific method and practice we don't think adequate? What basis can there be for criticizing some conceptions, or as we may think, misconceptions of scientific method and practice? Perhaps, one feels in dark moments, it's not going to be possible to secure any deeper normative or perhaps other form of justification. Now, that line of thought you will all recognize because it's been quite widely adopted in sociological and historical, you might want to say historicist work on the natural sciences, and it is, of course, a position in which relativists end up, or you might say it's a position that ends up in relativism. In my experience, it is a position that many scientists and many others find unconvincing and actually pretty irritating. Appeals to authority aren't only controversial. They often fail where those with very different views interact. Disagreements about norms are commonplace in a globalizing world, and very often no appeal to authority can be made to settle disputes. Which business practices amount to corruption or bribery? Commonplace question today. Where does the boundary between public and private life lie? What do norms of truth-telling and norms of politeness require, and where do we draw the boundaries? To what extent must medical practice be evidence-based, as opposed to perhaps what we might call confidence-based? If we can say nothing about justification other than bare assertions that some standards are authoritative in some contexts, won't we face rather than settle recurrent conflict? So I'm going to now dive into the deep water, but I hope to do it in quite a gentle way and ask that question, can normative disagreement be resolved? Questions about the justification of norms have been central to the work that I've been reading over a long time, done in political philosophy during the last half century. Some very prominent writers have claimed that we can justify norms by processes of public reasoning, in which those who lack a common tradition or culture, so start with normative disagreement, can move towards agreement. That's the general idea of public reasoning. In this way, it's hoped, or a lot of people hope, it might be possible to avoid the limitations of appealing to the ungrounded authority, illusory authority, if you will, of the actual social and moral norms of any group, which might be rejected or disputed by other groups. And various conceptions of public reason have been put forward as a basis for justifying norms by the most prominent political philosophers of the last half century, including the three I'm going to mention very briefly, Jürgen Habermas, John Rawls, and more recently, Amartya Sen. In The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, Habermas's first well-known book, he sets out an account of public reasoning as emerging during the European Enlightenment, when, as he plausibly states, the domination of the public sphere by the power of church and state waned. From the late 17th century, communication could, and this is surely true, take place more freely. For example, initially in salons and coffee houses, all around the corner here, in conversation and correspondence, in the Royal Society, in newspapers, in periodicals. Now, Habermas says that this Enlightenment world is a step towards a world that supports participation in debate by all competent persons within and perhaps beyond the boundaries of states. So it's a precursor to an increasingly democratic, potentially global conception of public reasoning, in which reasoning is free from coercion, and he claims, is going to lead across time to convergence and even consensus. But this account of public reason focuses on conditions for reasoners to participate. They must be free to participate. It doesn't actually focus on norms of reasoning that they ought to deploy. It's premised on, but doesn't aim to justify, norms, for example, of freedom, equality, democratic process that permit participation in public discourse. It says very little about the epistemic and ethical norms that perhaps should structure public discourse. The focus allows Habermas to draw close links between public reason and deliberative conceptions of democracy, and of course he's very well known for his work in that area. Such conceptions of democracy see citizens as exchanging views, seeking agreement, moving towards agreement. Any agreement that they reach will indeed count as democratically legitimated. That's been built into the picture. It's not, however, clear why it should be thought of as justified. After all, a consensus too may be iniquitous or unjustifiable, and there have been, and you will be able to think of widely accepted consensus views that actually were pernicious or false. In his later work, John Rawls proposed a partially similar account of public reason. He characterized it as statist way, as taking place among the citizens of a bounded, liberal, democratic, political society, who, as he put it, enter by birth and leave by death. It's, in that respect, a closed society. And these citizens are seen as willing to accept certain norms if others, too, will accept and abide by them. He sees public reasoning as independent of the many differing norms that may be accepted by sections of the public with differing moral, social, and religious views. So he doesn't actually think that public reasoning begins from or leads to consensus. He argues only that public reasoning can lead to agreement on basic principles of justice, but other sorts of disagreement, normative disagreement of many sorts, is going to persist. That's, by the way, why he called his position, it's an odd phrase seen in hindsight, political liberalism. He didn't mean this phrase as a tautology, but to indicate that he thinks public reasoning can establish the accounts of basic principles for politics, a theory of justice, but no more. It doesn't establish, for example, more widespread ethical agreement. And even those justifications are relativized to the context of a bounded, liberal, democratic polity. Analogously, context-restricted justifications of norms of scientific reasoning would, I think, seem inadequate to many of us. Amartya Sen, in recent work, took this line of thought a little bit further. He removed the assumptions that the reasons we appeal to in justifying have to be those of fellow citizens, and endorsed the thought that reasons might come from anyone, anywhere, in any society. So he weakens the link between a conception of public reason and conceptions of shared citizenship or democracy, and he sees it much more abstractly as what we might briefly characterize as the open-ended conversation of mankind, to borrow a phrase. Now let me turn to normative reasoning and scientific practice. I think that if we're to say something specific about the norms, including norms of reasoning, that matter for the practice of scientific investigation, we have to dig a bit deeper than these accounts of public reason. Normative claims can only be justified by showing how rigorous normative arguments can be built up. And needless to say, those arguments have to start from certain premises. And in the case of normative reasoning, at least some of those premises must themselves be normative. This too follows from the Humean adage. Hume doesn't assert that norms are unjustifiable, but rather that their justification requires at least some normative premises. You can't derive an ought from an is, to use the slogan. But is justifying normative claims in principle more difficult than justifying the forms of empirical reasoning that we use when we aim to describe or explain or predict aspects of the natural world? The distinctive feature of normative work, I've suggested, is not that it makes no assumptions. That's a sort of bizarre view of what it should be. But that its direction of fit is unashamedly the converse of that which is characteristic of empirical or descriptive work, which aims at truth claims. Normative reasoning doesn't aim to be true of the way things actually are, but to specify standards or principles that things should be made to satisfy. It's action intended to be action guiding. Arguments about standards and attempts to justify standards aren't, however, confined to daily life or ethics or law or politics. All pursuit of knowledge, including scientific knowledge, also, I think, requires normative reasoning, and it matters to think about the justifications of the sorts of normative claims that are made within and needed for scientific and other investigatory practices. And of course, the norms of scientific practice are, as a matter of fact, a matter for daily discussion, much agreement, and some dispute. Some day-to-day examples. We constantly need to make decisions about standards and units of measurement. We have discussions and decisions about research methods, discussions and decisions about research techniques, discussions and decisions about the adequacy of various forms of peer review and perhaps the inadequacy of other forms of organizing scientific publication. We have discussion and decisions about the adequacy of various forms of communication and engagement with science. In each case, I think what we're discussing are the norms that are to be used to shape the world of science, and the questions would simply be begged by looking to actual practice in order to determine what those norms should be. So looking at what you may think ropey publication practices in some particular domain simply wouldn't bear on the normative question. It's perfectly okay to say, yes, that may be what's going on, but that is not a good idea for the following reasons. Actual practice, as in other domains, may be better or worse. Well, if normativity is pervasive across all types of inquiry, including scientific inquiry, then presumably questions about the justification or lack of justification for specific norms is going to arise for all forms of inquiry. Attempts to justify normative standards that are widely relied upon for scientific purposes are, of course, widely discussed, certainly not only within science, to my knowledge, extensively within philosophy of science and epistemology. And That's analogous to the fact that ethical, political, and legal norms are widely discussed in contemporary work in jurisprudence, political philosophy, and ethics. The range of norms that have to be considered, ranging from domain-specific norms about choices of notations, metrics, conventions, at one end, and very generic norms of epistemic responsibility that matter in and beyond scientific practice are, I think, at the other end. But there's an enormous spectrum in between. The more generic norms will certainly include considerations about consistency, coherence, seeking and respecting evidence, norms of qualifying or rejecting or revising beliefs that have been tentatively held when there is contrary evidence. But in my view, we need to add to these certain norms for communication, including those that are going to have to be respective if content, in this case scientific content, is to be intelligible to intended audiences and accessible by those audiences. And that, I think, is also indispensable for robust practices of inquiry. And of course, nobody actually doubts that norms of honesty and integrity in the conduct of research and in responding to others' checks and challenges are also needed. Moreover, I think it is plausible, as well as traditional, to think that scientific inquiry needs to be informed by at least some aesthetic norms and standards. For example, simplicity and elegance are often cited. In short, I think it's hard to see how science could be practiced by anyone who insists that it's possible, let alone essential, to maintain scrupulous value neutrality. But one could ask, is there any need for specifically ethical norms? I think you can see from my very skimpy examples that if honesty and integrity, truth-telling and respect for evidence matter, at least some things that we normally take to be ethical standards matter. But I believe that in the end, and this may be what somewhat confuses matters, it may not be either feasible or useful to provide a clear or definitive taxonomy of the norms that matter for scientific inquiry. I doubt, for example, whether we can clearly classify the norms that are taken to be important in the practice of science or in other domains of inquiry as in an exhaustive way, saying this one is purely logical, this is merely epistemic, this one's solely ethical, that one's solely aesthetic. That to me is a rather intriguing question because it begins to suggest that we can't really map norms neatly into our usual academic compartments. But I'm going to bracket that question. My own belief is that the most promising route, and now you'll be pretty grateful that I won't go into detail here, for justifying that the norms that matter most for practices of inquiry is not to drill down into some desired classification of all the norms that might matter for scientific and other practice or communication. But I think the following reflection is very useful. Science aims to offer reasons and evidence to all comers. Its audience is potentially unrestricted. Its claims, to use a phrase of Immanuel Kant's, are to reach the world at large. Science is not esoteric. When you begin to think about that idea of a potentially unrestricted audience, I believe you can see that certain norms will be particularly important. Content that is to be addressed to each and to all, granted, of course, that many of us will lack specialized knowledge to follow particular claims, will have to take a certain shape. Thinking about the scope of the intended audience for these claims offers an immediate way of filtering out the insertion of conditions that are actually local, parochial, or restricted in some way. Reasons that are addressed to each and to all have to be ones that everybody, without restriction, could in principle follow in thought. In practice, that may be harder. Proposing to others that certain claims are credible or that they should accept them is not going to work if those claims are not even comprehensible to those unrestricted audiences. The openness of science, in short, isn't a nice add-on feature. which we can all enjoy in a era of vastly improved communication technologies. It's actually a standard that's intrinsic to scientific practice. I think this standard cannot be met merely by practices of disclosure and dissemination. Transparency, as you all know, has become a very popular slogan for what should be done in public life and in science and more widely. But I think that the openness of science isn't a matter of mere transparency. Intelligibility and with it accessibility demand more. So transparency requires only that information be put in the public domain, that it be accessible. But much that is accessible is not widely, let alone unrestrictedly intelligible, let alone widely or unrestrictedly accessible. Transparency, in short, is a remedy for secrecy, but it falls far short of providing an adequate standard for communication that's intelligible and accessible to an audience that's not in principle restricted. What is needed, in my opinion, is not mere transparency, but more intelligent forms of openness that don't shirk the reality of seeking to communicate with those with whom one disagrees. During the very long post-positivist hangover that afflicted so many discussions of scientific method, not only in the middle, but throughout the 20th century, I think these thoughts often got buried or were even rejected or seemingly rejected. It was often suggested that the aims of science were rather more narrowly negative, a matter of avoiding pseudoscience, and that, of course, this required vigorous ethical neutrality or value neutrality. I think avoiding pseudoscience does matter enormously, but avoiding pseudoscience isn't a matter of seeking or espousing value neutrality. Indeed, it seems to me that if we take the idea of value neutrality seriously, this would mean that we would lack any reason to adopt the very norms on which we rely in distinguishing science from pseudoscience. Thank you very much.
It's the fun bit.
Yes. Okay, well, Baroness O'Neill is happy to enter into discussion. Maybe I could just start because you always make me think. And it's much easier just to watch a slide. So it's tough on the ordinary scientist who looks at a bunch of slides. But I started thinking about norms. I mean, one of the norms, we tend to publish evidence which is underlying our conclusion, but we don't publish evidence which we've seen but doesn't seem to be relevant. This becomes very important in clinical trials. And I just wondered whether you had any thoughts about whether we are going to evolve in that direction in changing the norms, maybe first in things like clinical trials, where it's quite important, but sort of going back into the broad area of more basic science.
Yes, I have to be very careful here and declare something of an interest, as I'm on the Medical Research Council and chair the Ethics Committee. You knew that.
Yeah, so. I know that.
So this is my view, and I'm allowed to have them still. I think the publication of negative results sounds an extremely good idea, but it's not practically as easy as you might think. And I don't just mean that lots of journals won't want to publish them. I think the difficulties about the investment of time and effort to work up the inconclusive results, it's quite easy to think that's not of interest. Steps that I hope are going to be agreed are and the MRC has moved to this, that if you conduct a clinical trial, you have to register it. Now, that is already very important, because if you don't know what trials other people have conducted, then there's no mechanism by which you can say, well, something must be known or established there. But there are I think, very serious reasons to think that the publication of negative results matters, particularly in medicine, because any second-order study, any meta-study, is going to be skewed if you don't have a complete set of results. So I think that matters. I can see why people don't like to be thought to be the scientist who got a fabulous series of inconclusive results. But so, step one, yes, surely it does make sense to push towards requirements to publish negative results as well as other results. And there's not much excuse now that it's cheap to publish online.
No.
There are probably some steps beyond that, because particularly when you come to clinical trials, this is not something that MRC has taken a stand on, but clinical trials, as many of you know, are extremely expensive and very slow, and a lot of people resent the great delay before there is access to something that might help them. I've been to a couple of seminars discussing whether it is possible to, as it were, reconstruct clinical trials after the availability of a drug that has, of course, been safety tested by requiring the provision of the data that you would accumulate in a clinical trial, but without recruiting the cohorts you'd have to recruit for a clinical trial. I think that's a more open question, but it is obviously one of them.
Right. I better not get into a debate with you, but I think that's going to be absolutely critical for the development of medicines, just simply because the phase three. But it is an interesting argument from the right in many ways in the States, which is converging with other views, especially in infectious disease where one can't fund it. But this is a diversion. I should ask the audience to come in with a better question than I had. Yes, please, at the back.
It's good.
Yes, please. Sorry, the lady there. Sorry, you're looking round. You've had your hand up. Yes. I see the microphone you're after. Right.
Thank you very much for a very illuminating talk. Thank you very much. I wanted to go back to your question about the role of authority in establishing norms and that interaction with science inquiry. I'm particularly interested in how science influences government policy, and I often see articles and read articles about how government policy seems to dictate what science should be researching or what results that they take on. And I just wondered if you could comment a little bit more about that.
Yes, I realise I said nothing about the role of normative considerations in research funding, and it's a very important role. And I suppose that we have a mixed economy, don't we? Because on the one hand, we have research councils funding on a competitive basis with other scientists judging quality, and it's all Haldane principle-ish. On the other hand, we also have government initiatives and research council initiatives and much more prescriptive ways of distributing research funding. I think that's fairly common in a number of systems of research funding. I suppose there are other systems where it might be a much larger element of central control, but I've tended to think that a dual economy, though it might not get every decision right, that's to say some less good projects or less promising projects might get funding when some more projects which one thought were clearly superior did not get funding. But on the whole, I think there's some safety in a mixed economy, although it's laborious. I don't know whether that speaks to what you're thinking about, but government policy, things like catapults, yes, it's a lot of money, but the research councils also have quite a lot of money.
Anyone else? Okay.
Miss Dougal, isn't it?
Ah, yes.
I'm Dougal Goodman from the Foundation for Science and Technology. Thank you for a very interesting talk. I just wondered how your framework might apply to international bodies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and their summary for policymakers. In particular, the way in which they've developed a language to define likely, very likely, and so on. How does that fit in with your framework of norms?
But one of the nice things about a normative framework is that it is open to criticism. It is provisional. It might get things wrong. People are able to criticize and suggest revisions, and they do. So I wouldn't know enough about the framework of measurement being used by IPCC to say, but this is it, this is definitive. So what I think we're surrounded by is authorities with question marks. And you wouldn't put a question mark if your research funder, for example, said to you, we want annual reports while the project goes on. That's just a sort of, they set up a standard you have to meet. You might think that's too frequent or not frequent enough, but that's not the sort of norm we dispute. But other norms, that is part of the debate, that we seek to justify or criticize those norms. So it's not the case that certain norms jump out at us as beyond question. I mean, I have a little penchant for thinking that some priority has to be given to questions of consistency. But that's probably a déformation professionnelle.
Anyone else? I must say, having chaired the Royal Commission on the Environment as this emerging climate change issues come, I often think that the honesty of that panel could be sort of shared more broadly. But it would be amazingly difficult for us to publish anything if we said, you know, we were 97% certain, as in fact they've said recently.
But 97% is fantastic.
Please.
Thank you. I was really taken with your talk, but one thing struck me was that you didn't say anything about the power relations within and between different scientific communities.
Yes.
And I wondered if you'd like to expand on that and see it as relevant to some of the points you were making.
I suspect this audience knows a good deal more than I do about them, but it must surely be the case that across time one sees different branches of science or different research programs, I think I'd say, not individual research projects, but different programs are held in high esteem and perhaps get a lot of funding. I have heard people talk about how wonderful the LMB was in Cambridge in the past, evidenced 13 Nobel Prizes, but you have to say, could one replicate that under current conditions? So I think I have the view that you have to construct corrective mechanisms within the system of funding and plurality of funders is one of the most valuable things there. One thing one might say about this country is that we have a remarkable plurality of funders in the biomedical sciences. That's, of course, welcome, but it's also the medical research charities more broadly. And that seems to me a thoroughly good thing. I'm not against constellations and collaborations of funding because interests may come together, but plurality has something to be said for it, and surely the system that you would most worry about would be where all capacity to fund sat with the ministry, not to mention the party, as has happened in the past. So I think plurality, which does not, after all, prevent the emergence of agreement when the science is good and effective, but it is a certain sort of restraint on the power relations becoming too dominant in what happens, what research gets funded and not funded. So I've heard people say, and I've never known close-up good examples, but I'm sure there are, that one of the things that is really valuable is some pot of money that is almost eccentrically distributed, because that way you might catch somebody whose research is frowned on by the powerful, but actually fruitful. So could one write a recipe for how much, what proportion of a research budget should be given out in a sort of counter-cultural way in terms of the norms of science funding? Probably not, but I can see the point of that.
I think we'd take one more question if it is, and then we can have an informal discussion. Yes, please. Can you bring the...
Thank you. Roland Jackson from ScienceWise. Just following up your question on openness and the question on sort of power structure just now, if you look at, and the question of distribution of research monies, if you look at the governing bodies of the research councils, so the research councils and their membership, they're almost exclusively academics or scientists from the business community, with very few other stakeholders represented. How does that fit with your concept of an intelligent openness?
Well, certainly on the Medical Research Council, we have a number of people whose domain of activity is business and not research. And I declare my hand as a not a scientist on that council. I thought that other research councils also had a number of members who were not practicing and had not been practicing scientists. The way we've solved it to some extent at the Medical Research Council is that we have, as it were, parallel bodies which are there for their expertise, but the decision-making is considerably informed by other things. An interesting question, though, and I don't know the correct answer to this, is how do you get the right sort, the right level, the right measure of public engagement? I'm sure some of you have been on public engagement panels or perhaps are members of public engagement panels. My experience is limited, but I think that a difficulty is that, first of all, the people who serve on those panels give a great deal and a great deal of their time, but they often have a particular passion, different from that of the research scientists, but a focus, for example, on their disease or their particular area that they feel ought to be developed. So one of the things that I think one has to look to is a more active form of I hate the jargon, stakeholder engagement, that speaks to more different people of more different views. I think we're very fortunate again in this country to have such an active set of medical research charities and patient support groups, because at least for the biomedical sciences, we have lots of people whom you might characterize as lay experts who have a different perspective, a different interest, but enough understanding of it all to be very serious commentators on the enterprise of science funding. Diana knows all about this.
Right. Well, unless anybody's really pressing, I think perhaps we better, as we started late...
Mea culpa.
Question down the... We better bring this to a conclusion. I think we have a presentation... if you'd like to bring it up, Karen.
My goodness. I was so late, I don't deserve it. Thank you so much. That's really so very sweet of you. I'm very honoured to do it, and then I just read the time.
Not to worry. We'll have another cup of tea, so.
I missed the tea, yes. I hope it was good tea.
Well, let me say that was a fantastic lecture and a very good discussion. We can certainly continue it. I might say, as a chairman of a research council, we do have people who are not academics, we do have people interested in ethics, and we do have a large number of people who are coming from industry and quite often in the management side. So I think it's easier on the council level, much more difficult lower down. But yeah, I think that sort of issue is one which is very topical and one that we really need to debate. I have to say that I think I've followed John Rawls in my shopping list. My wife and I share the shopping, and we do have a process of deliberation and understanding about the meaning of the shopping list. It's not a final solution, but we're on the way. But I'd like to just thank you very, very much for a fantastic lecture, and let's all go and have a drink and relax and have a talk.
You've been listening to a special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist point of view. Thanks for listening.